This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
Well, I would like this podcast to become one of the most popular in the world. Can you convince me to make that happen?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you're already doing it.
Yeah, I got you, I guess.
You got me on that. No, but you're always doing it every week. You have the... Yeah. You're committed to it. It's consistent, right?
Yeah, every Monday.
Well, if you want to be the most popular in the world, then why can't it?
Yeah.
Why can't it be? I don't understand why it can't be. How I've attacked anything is just, okay, who is doing this the best? How do I do it better than them? So you have to look at what you want, and then who has it, and then how you can do it better than them. Mm. So it's very simple.
Hot breath. Yo, hot breath-averse. It's I, your host, comedian Joel Byers, reporting live from my car, post-show intro. And you know what time it is. Hot breath. Oh, that old familiar sound. This is the Hot Breath Podcast, your weekly guide to comedy mastery. I'm a comedian on a mission to share as much comedy game with as many comedians as possible. And this episode is with a comedian on the same mission who is doing it his own way. He was just on Joe Rogan, completely blew the roof off. And if you have not gone to his YouTube page, not only in this interview does he drop game on how he moves and strategizes in this comedy world, but if you go to his YouTube page, he has set the template for comedians. Straight up, go check out his YouTube page. Look at how it is built like a network. This guy is doing it his own way, and he drops how you can do it your own way in this interview. So grab a pen, grab a pad, take notes. He's about to take us to school. All I ask, this podcast is free. I'm not charging you. All I ask, if you find this episode valuable, if you find it educational, reach out to my guest, hit him up on Instagram, hit him up on Twitter, hit him up on Facebook and say, yo, your episode on Hot Breath changed the way I approach comedy. It changed my whole mindset, my whole motivation behind this comedy grind. Because like me, and like you, he is on a mission to help as many comics get as good as comedy as possible. And in this episode, he certainly achieves that. So I'm not asking you to leave a 5-star review on iTunes, unless you want to. I'm not asking to go buy some Hot Breath merch, unless you want to, linked in the show notes. All I'm asking, hit him up, let him know this episode is the real deal, and thank him for all the wisdom he shared. It's also on YouTube, our YouTube channel. Someone already commented on the video saying, this interview is better than the one he did with Joe Rogan. So that's all I'm going to say. I did this interview a couple years ago, and I thought back in Hot Breath episode number 86, and I thought, man, let's throw it back to the top of the pyramid. Let these hot brother and sister know this guy has been on a mission, and the success he's having right now is all on purpose. It's all part of his plan. So I hope this episode motivates you to create your own plan and get on Hot Breath one day. So that being said, let's get into it. I've got to get back to my show. I'm actually recording this after my set at this showcase I'm doing here in Atlanta. So enjoy the episode, share it, let my guests know it's the real deal. And there is only one thing left to do. And that is inhale a hot breath with Andrew Schulz.
It's just water. That was, caffeinate your ears was the slogan when we first started.
Good shit.
Now we don't have a slogan. That one just doesn't make any sense.
Got really. You.
People are like, what does that even mean?
With it.
Nice. Does yours have a slogan? Do you guys have a slogan?
Brilliant Idiots Podcast.
It's Brilliant Idiots Podcast.
No, I don't think we do. Sometimes we have like a... No, we don't have a slogan.
You guys are just you. I guess when you have heat, then you don't need a slogan to try to draw people in.
We are the slogan.
Yeah.
Well, that's some intense coffee right there, man.
It's all for you, man.
Banjo Brew Coffee. All right.
Yep. Atlanta's finest, just for you, buddy.
Respect.
How's Atlanta been treating you down here?
I like Atlanta.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's a gold mine down here.
What do you say that for?
It's cheap property. You get a lot for it, and there's industry here. I don't think we'll be like that much longer, but maybe for like the next few years. It's just random. Like, you're not supposed to have opportunity and cheap property.
Mm.
Right?
Okay.
Like, property value should go up with opportunity. You go to Los Angeles, shit is expensive. Go to New York, shit is expensive. I mean, I just bought a place in New York, one bedroom that I'm turning it into one bedroom. It's an alcove, studio with an alcove, $600,000. I get a castle out here for $600,000. Right?
Wow, yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you have you have the music industry out here. You have film is rapidly growing out here. You see all these shows being filmed. You have Walking Dead is out here, like major shows.
Yeah.
And then
it's a good comedy scene too.
Comedy scene is growing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got definitely a lot of, you know, strong comics. All I'm saying is property should be more expensive than it is.
Yeah.
How long for the opportunity you get?
How long you've been performing in Atlanta? Like, what's kind of your connection here?
I only came two other times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The recent.
Yeah, recently. I did one at the Atlanta Comedy Theater.
Uh-huh.
And then I did a little one-nighter there. And then now I'm doing this weekend right here at the Punchline Comedy Diner.
Well, I was at the one last night.
That's right.
And there was that was a good crowd. And it seemed most of them, well, first they gave you a standing ovation.
That was cool.
Opening the show with a standing ovation.
So kind of takes away from the standing O when I leave, right? Because it's like you got to stand or else it was lowered your expectation. Like, I didn't meet expectations. If you're willing to stand for me to go onto the stage, the least you could do is stand when I leave, right?
Have people been doing that a lot lately?
It's weird. I have been starting to get some standing ovations, and it will be like, it won't be like the whole place. I feel like you kind of milk it for the whole place. I just get off before that because I'm too uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
But like, you know, like 15 people will stand up. And then if you are one of those guys, you could be like, oh, thank you. And you just stand. And then out of sheer awkwardness, I think other people will start to stand.
Uh-huh.
I just get off before then. But yeah, it's happening. But it's a function. I think it's a function of like having fans show up to your shows. I think it's very difficult to get a standing ovation from people that do not know you, even though they find you oftentimes funnier, right? Because their expectation might be lower. Your fans support your funny the most, right? They'll give it up, etc. But they're not going to be as surprised by your funny as a complete stranger, like some random guy who's 45 years old in the audience that just came out. He's like, yeah, this guy might be funny. His expectation is low.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. A lot of those guys, it seemed, were from the podcast. They were yelling out podcast quotes and everything.
Yeah, dick talk. Yeah, a lot of dick talk yellers. Yeah. No, it's the best, dude. Having a podcast is the best. It's also great because it you get past one of the most frustrating parts of stand-up, which is one of my least favorite parts of stand-up, which is introducing an audience to your sensibility without alienating them.
Hmm.
So if these people already understand my comedic sensibility, where I'm going to like, you know, justify some horrible shit and I'm going to challenge conventional wisdom, like they're already waiting for that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, when you're a famous comedian like Louis C.K., these type of people, like the audience is ready for these types of jokes from you. Right. They're not shocked by it. So when you have some people that are aware of that, it makes it easier for you to get into these taboo topics because you don't need to pussyfoot around it. And like risk alienating these people.
Yeah, I'd imagine with your style, you probably have gotten some mixed reactions developing that style.
Oh my God. Yeah, girls would go, they used to throw fucking candles at me and shit like that, like lit candles.
Oh, wow.
People used to fight. I got punched in the face once on stage.
What?
Tons, yeah.
Have you ever been booed?
Oh, fuck yeah, of course.
What's your favorite boo story?
I mean, boos aren't even close to as interesting. Like, boos are easy. You could flip a boo.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, that's not like when people boo me, it doesn't, like, if I'm getting booed, it doesn't count in the same way as a boo. It's not like boo. It's like, boo, you're bad. You're not funny. It's boo. I don't enjoy you justifying these things that I think are horrible.
Mm.
I don't mind that. Because that boo is just the same as an O. It's just their way of saying, I don't agree with this. I need everybody in this room to know that I don't agree with that sensibility. Mm-hmm. A boo of just, you're not funny. That's got to hurt. I don't think I've ever got one of those, but that's got to hurt. That is just rough. I've bombed plenty of times, but yeah, never to the point where it was so offensive. Never where the bombing was so just outright offensive to the audience that they felt a need to make sound back at you, right?
Like, they would just rather come up and punch you in the face. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I was my first time ever doing a hood room, and I was just talking shit to one of these guys in a crowd, and he just walked up and punched me in the face. And I threw him out, and they handed me back the microphone. They're like, "All right, man, keep doing your thing."
Did you ever go back?
Yeah, next week.
Yeah,
gotta
that's
do
what
it.
You gotta do, man.
Gotta do it.
Yeah,
right away.
Seems like you have a nice mixed following now. Like last night, the crowd was a little bit of everybody there.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. That's what club owners always say. They don't know how to say, "We're surprised that black people are at your show." So they go, "Wow, your audience is quite diverse." Uh-huh. Quite diverse.
A little urban in here tonight.
Exactly. You know who's not a fan of that? The waitresses.
Yeah, you worked in a restaurant.
Apparently they're not tipping as much as the white patrons. Apparently. That stereotype might have some truth to it. Apparently. I can't say. Allegedly, according to waitresses at the Punchline Comedy Diner.
Oh, they just told you that this week. That's funny.
I always ask the waitresses how they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they taking care of you, this, that, the other.
Yeah.
And they just gave him a couple eye rolls.
So well, you understand that hustle. You've worked in restaurants.
Of course.
Yeah.
Got to make your money, man. They're not getting paid. They make money on tips.
But you were a manager, right?
Manager, yeah. I managed two restaurants into the ground. Put two restaurants out of business. Yeah. Very proud of that.
Were those both in California?
No, one in California, then moved back to the city and just put that one right down the drain too.
What did you do?
I think the restaurants are tough, right? They can be doomed already, but like I just gave suggestions that were really bad too that didn't help.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with the second one, that wasn't my fault. I walked into a doomed situation. And I didn't want to... I wanted to turn around, but I didn't want to put the effort into turning around because I didn't care.
Right.
Like I wanted to do stand up. I didn't want to manage restaurants. You know, it was just a job right after college and it just opened up and I was like, all right, I'll do this. I'll be the GM of a restaurant. But I wasn't like going, how do we change this? How do we fix this? What should we do?
Right.
I was okay to babysit, which is what you're doing when you manage a restaurant. You're a fucking babysitter for adults that don't want to be there.
Nobody wants to be there.
Nobody wants to. Like, if you work at a restaurant, you have a dream to do something else. So nobody that's there wants to be there. So you have to watch people that don't want to be there and tell them what to do that don't want to be there. And they're adults.
So you couldn't use your psychology to kind of manipulate them at all?
You try, but you know what I mean? But at the same time, it's like you try to motivate them, right? But like... I also have a tough time motivating people that like don't want to work.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can motivate you if you want it and I can say that you want it. I can make you believe in yourself. Like if you want it, but you don't believe in yourself, I can make you believe in yourself and I can make you believe that you can do something. I can't deal with laziness and like a lack of integrity. Just do the fucking job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like because I don't have any respect for those people. So it's like, it's hard to manage people you don't have respect for. Just do the job.
Well, I would like this podcast to become one of the most popular in the world. Can you convince me to make that happen?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, you're already doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I got you. I guess.
You got me on there. No, but you're already doing it every week. You have the, you're committed to it. It's consistent, right?
Yeah. Every Monday.
Well, if you want to be the most popular in the world, then why can't it?
Yeah.
Why can't it be? I don't understand why it can't be.
What are some of your biggest goals? Like, because I'm saying most popular podcast in the world. What are some of the goals you've set that were high-reaching?
Brilliant Idiots to be the most popular podcast in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think we're on the way to doing that. It's just, and then what basically the how I've attacked anything is just, okay, who is doing this the best? How do I do it better than them? So mm-hmm. you have to look at what you want and then who has it and then how you can do it better than them. So it's very simple, you know, so how can you make this podcast? You're interviewing people. Okay. Who's got the best interview podcast? you know, in this field. Okay. Who is he? Oh, he's interviewing more famous people than me. All right. I got to interview more famous people. He's interviewing more interesting people than me. You could turn that off if you want to get rid of the sound.
That'd be great.
No.
Wait.
Where no, the- just right there. Oh, yeah.
There it is.
Just analyze who's doing the thing successfully and then be better than that.
Who are some people you've been
analyzing in terms of podcasts
or just in your career? All of the stuff you've been doing.
I mean, you know, for stand up, it was like, I just looked at the game. I was like, okay, what do I need to do? First of all, I need to get undeniably funny. That's the first thing. How do I get undeniably funny? I get on stage as much as I can. So I was barking for a club, which means handing out tickets to go to a club in exchange for stage time. So I was getting up tons of times a week in front of real audiences very early on in my career. And I was probably getting up 5-7 times a week in front of real audiences early in my career. Unheard of. So I had an advantage.
In New York.
So it's in New York.
Yeah.
Then I stopped working at one of those clubs. I kind of got like fired from barking, or one club closed. They didn't ask me to work at the other one. So I basically, we found this other place that was around the block and they had shows there, and they were just kind of like free shows, asking people to come off the street. And I got involved in that club and I started working for one of the guys there, and we were just kind of friendly, and I was running his shows. I just found a place to get up consistently. Then I started running a couple shows there with friends. We would just ask people, strangers from the streets, to come in. And it was great because when you have your own show, you have your own show. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it might be repeat audience.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't work the same jokes out because it's the same audience. So it's good because you're practicing new jokes, but you're not getting good at anything. You know, it's like you're learning a new like pool shot every week. It's like you're not getting really better at pool. You're just kind of getting marginally better at these new jokes that you never really get to try. But we could work on the same jokes for months because it was a different group of people coming in every week. So we did that. Then once I felt like I was undeniably funny, at least funny to the point where I feel like I could, you know, be on stage with these other guys who were on stage.
And how long into your career was that?
A few years in. I mean, now I would look back and be like, oh, I was awful. But for the time, I was able to go, you know, I'm good enough to be on the stage with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why are they on the stage? So I started analyzing the people I saw at all the clubs. And it was like Sherrod Small, like James Smith, and these kind of comics. And they were all on Best Week Ever. And I noticed all the comics who were on Best Week Ever were performing at all the clubs. Christian Finnegan. And I was like, okay, I need to get on a show that is a weekly show that will give me some leverage. So now, because it's not just about funny. It's like, if you're as funny as all the other guys, okay, you got to be funnier than them and have something. So I got on Guy Code, and that was my weekly. Now I had some leverage. Now I could go to a club and be like, hey, I'm on a TV show every week. Can I get on?
Yeah. How'd you get on Guy Code?
Make
it sound so easy.
It was kind of, there was some, you know, one of the good things is like knowing what you want to do.
Mm.
So like I did a New Year's Eve show, like one of those countdown shows for MTV. So I got into the MTV door. They really liked me. So I had a meeting with them. I was pitching a show, which I ended up not really wanting to do, but at least like the person saw I was interesting. And then while pitching it, she asked me like what my thing was. And I was just like, I got a guy's perspective. I got an unapologetically male, and you know, this is how I feel. And I'd like to be the voice for men nowadays. And I feel like they don't really have a voice. And all of a sudden, Guy Code came down the pipeline, and she remembered that meeting. She's like, I'd like to suggest a guy. Now, had I never said what I truly want to do, maybe I would have never got that meeting, right? Most people, I think, put this wide umbrella, this wide net, but the net is so wide, it never catches anything.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? If you say specifically what you want to do to people, when a project comes up this specific, they'll think about you for it. If you're like, I just want to be on television, nobody's remembering the meeting where the guy goes, I just want to be on television, and going, okay, I should put that. They will remember the meeting. It's like, listen, I love monster trucks. That's my shit. I'm a monster truck aficionado. If a monster truck show comes on, they can be like, I remember meeting this guy who's into monster trucks. You know what I'm saying? So know what you want. And then when something comes down the line, people tag you for it.
There was one time you were on five shows.
Yeah.
Simultaneously.
Yeah. I was a guy at MTV for a minute.
So you understand the TV game and all that. Maybe you could provide some insight into maybe first off, even just how to pitch a show. What are they?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't pitch any of them. You know, yeah. I just had a contract with MTV and they could put me on as many things as they wanted. And there was a moment in history at MTV where I was the guy. You know, I hosted everything from a dating show to this jobs show. I was on Guy Code, Girl Code, Jobs That Don't Suck. I hosted Spring Break. I hosted another, you know, festival. Like I was just, they would just throw me on everything.
Did the awards show in Europe? Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I hosted the EMAs out there in Europe for like the American syndication of it. But it was a cool time, man. I was just busy as fuck and bouncing around. They put me on everything. It was definitely cool. Yeah. We're not on the same page anymore.
Is that you just grew apart or did an event happen?
I think an event sparked it, but also it was also some frustration on both of our parts. I also think maybe like, I don't want to blame my manager, but I think my manager made some poor decisions at the time. I'm no longer with him, but I think that led to a kind of aggravated relationship between the two of us. Mm. Like he allowed me to do a show on a competing channel that I thought was okay to do, but it turns out it wasn't. That kind of pissed off the MTV folks. But after we already had a little bit of a, you know, kind of tumultuous relationship, I didn't want to do any more corny shows.
Gotcha.
I had bad experiences with a couple of corny shows and I had realized I'm not really into that. I want to do these kind of fun, interesting shows. And they also wanted to make a show kind of based on Brilliant Idiots. And I felt that that was our entity and our project. And they kind of felt like since they introduced me and Charlamagne that they owned it, not owned it, but like we're entitled to it creatively mm-hmm. in some way. And I was like, nah, fam, that's not what it is. So that show ends up being Uncommon Sense, which is Charlamagne's show.
Oh, okay.
And I was asked to be on it, you know, but originally those talks started with the possibility of us doing some sort of Brilliant Idiots show, or is it a segment on a show, or how we do it. And I was just protective of it. I was, you know, I remember they called me. It was like, hey, we want you and Charlamagne to do this like weekly show where you guys have, I remember they're all on the phone. They asked me to come for a meeting, but it snowed. So we all had a call. But we want you to have this weekly show where you guys, you know, talk about the pop culture things, you and Charlamagne. And then you maybe have a guest and then you take questions from fans. Now, the formula for Brilliant Idiots is we talk about pop culture, have a guest, and then we do Ask an Idiot. That's what we were doing. Mm-hmm. So when they said that to me, I was just on the phone and they're waiting for me to be like, oh my God, awesome guys. Thank you so much. And I was like, well, isn't that Brilliant Idiots? And they're like, well, this is a popular format. Da, da, da. And I was like, all right, cool, man. You know, and they're like, we want to call it Guy Code Live. And I go, well, haven't we done the whole Guy Code thing already? Isn't that... That's already kind of, well, the Guy Code brand is bigger than, you know, Brilliant Idiots brand. It absolutely was, but they just didn't like my lack of enthusiasm.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Do you know how Guy Code all got started? Because I had Billy Sorrells on here. Are you familiar with Billy Sorrells?
How do I know that guy?
Oh, there was a whole controversy where he had this YouTube segment that then magically appeared as this MTV2 show called Guy Code.
So he had a show called Guy Code?
It wasn't called Guy Code, but there were like specific sketches that were pretty much mirror image.
Get out of here.
No.
Like what?
There was like a whole lawsuit and everything.
Get the fuck out of here.
I'm serious. Yeah. He's on Wild and Out now and everything. So he's like, he's back. He's been working with MTV too again. But like, yeah, it was a whole ordeal. He had to sit down with like Viacom and everything.
Wow. He sued Viacom.
But I guess as the talent, you guys don't hear the behind the scenes, but it was just interesting. I don't know if you knew.
God, no. I mean, I know the guy who made it, Ryan Ling, and he's put me in a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, I continue to work with Ryan. I mean, I'll be honest. I don't think there's any creative genius behind the idea of a show that just talks about what men should do. I mean, GQ has been telling us to do that for years. Maxim has been telling us to do that for years. I don't think the idea is that novel. It just so happened that it was put into a place where people really gravitated to it.
You know? Yeah, and you've seen similar with like the Comedy Central, like with the David Tell stand-up show where you were You were talking to Comedy Central, you just passingly about this.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
just
yeah.
appeared Dave Attell at the same venue you were talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yeah, that's so funny. Wow, yeah, you've done your research. You go deep. Yeah, that's right. I had a meeting with Comedy Central. Has never put me on their channel. I've never gotten that much love from the stand-up comedy industry. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I had a meeting with them and I was like, yeah, it'd be really cool if, you know, you just showcase like what it's like in a club, you know? And I was talking to, and I remember as I mentioned, I was talking to Dave Attell about it. I'd be like, yeah, it'd be cool just showcasing, you know, what it's like to be in a club in New York, you know, and that kind of experience. And why don't we shoot at the, you know, underground this, that, where? And they're like, hey, that's interesting. Never heard back from them. And then I just saw that show come on Comedy Central. And the worst part was, they didn't even ask me to be in the fucking show.
Right.
You know what I mean? Now, right. I don't know if you already had that in the pipeline or not, but it's like, if you did have it in the pipeline, you might as well mention it in the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't look like, you know, you're biting the shit that I'm pitching you. But this happens all the time.
Yeah. Why do you think you haven't been as, I guess, lack of a better word, embraced in the stand-up world?
It's a weird thing. I think there's a lot of maybe judge a book by its cover with me. You know, I think like people see me, they're like, I maybe don't look like a traditional goofy weirdo stand-up guy. You know, I think I kind of look like the guy who maybe bullied these people in high school, which is why they're a stand-up in the first place.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
So I think that's the assumption of me, because when people see my set, actually, the initial reaction is this, I am this way. Oh, he's fucking douchey, you know, fucking beer pong bro, frat bro, you know. And then you see my set and it's like, oh shit, no, these are like good thoughts. This guy's kind of smart. What's going on? Oh, this is not what I expected. And I just feel like you need to get past that in order to maybe see me. But I've never been really championed by the industry in that regard. I'm also like a 30-year-old white dude. That's not really what the industry is looking for right now. If I was trans, I'd be on every fucking stand-up special in the world. You know what I mean? That yeah. being said, outside, whatever makes your life harder in life makes it easier for you in stand-up. Whatever makes it easy for you in stand-up makes your life way harder in life. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's true.
So being 6'2 with a full head of hair, white, makes life pretty great.
Yep.
Stand up, I got to work extra hard to compete with these people.
Better grow a beard and put on a flannel shirt.
Exactly. Yeah. I got to fit some. Even that's probably played out. I got to have something
now
else.
Now it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I got to be like autistic. How can he overcome this? It's like, funny is not about funny anymore. It's about like boxes you check off. Like, it sounds bitter, but I don't actually mind it. And it bothered me a lot at first because it was like, oh, this is what I love, and I'm on stage with these people, and I know I'm funnier than them, so that's never been a question. But it's like, man, why haven't I been embraced in the same way or given the same opportunities? You know, like even for me to do Montreal, you know, the comedy festival.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like for most people to do new faces on Montreal, they're a new face to comedy. They haven't done anything in the comedy world. For me to do new faces, I already had a 6-figure deal with MTV, and I already had 2 of my own shows that I was hosting coming onto air and 2 TV shows that I was like a major part of that were already on air. So, you know how like you hear people talk about like marginalized minorities, about like what they need to do in order to get a shot, you know, like what Barack needed to actually overcome in order to be president is way different than George Bush or whatever like that. Like what I had to do just to get new faces in Montreal was unprecedented.
That's impressive.
Nobody's been more qualified for new faces in Montreal history than me. That's got to be a fact.
Yeah. How many years into your career was that?
I don't know. I forget, to be honest with you. But but never invited back to Montreal either. Very interesting. There's some kind of, I don't know if it's stigma. It's so interesting. It's like, in order for me, the weird thing for me has always been like, give me the people, not the industry. If you give me the people, we're good. Like I'm the guy who like you got to just test the show. Like you put me on the show and you're like, all right, we'll put him on. I think it's fine. And then you get the results back from when you test the pilot test.
Right.
And they're like, oh yeah, we love that guy.
Mm-hmm.
The people love that. And then the network embraces it. So my feeling is like, just get it to the people. I don't want to hear what you got to say. network. Don't worry about it. Yeah, you guys have your opinions. That's fine. Just give it to the people. They'll tell you what to do.
Have you tried to even do like late night spots, like a Conan or anything? Have you?
I started preparing it a little bit, and I was so miserable in preparing it that I just was like, I don't, one, want to do this. Two, I don't see the return on investment. You know, like it's you're investing time, you're investing fun. Like it's not fun to work on these sets. I don't get to do comedy how I normally do comedy or speak how I want to speak on stage. And the return on investment is what? Nothing.
Right? Just the credit. But you already have credits, I guess.
It's like I already have TV, right. You know? So like, and I already have something that brings people to the shows. So it's like, would I do it? Yes. Would I love to do the couch where we have the conversation? Absolutely. And will I eventually do it in the future? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't something I felt like would really help me now.
That's what's interesting is you've done all this television, but pretty much everybody at your show last night was from the podcast.
Yeah. TV doesn't do the same thing anymore.
It's lost its power.
Yeah. It's just, it's not that it's lost its power, but one, there's just so much TV, but two, there's a difference between being on TV and being on something you watch. I was a lead in a sitcom. Nobody comes out to shows because of that. It's a sitcom on IFC called Benders. Now it's on Netflix. Did one season. Nobody comes out to shows because of that. Guy Code was a wildly popular show. These kids who watch it were a little too young to come out to the comedy club. But when I would do colleges, there were 1,000 people in the audience. It was unbelievable. Lines down the fucking campus. I mean, it was unbelievable when we would do these shows. So there's a difference between just being on TV doesn't mean people come out to your shows. You have to be on something that people relate to and fuck with. Mm. And the podcast is the extreme version of that. Instead of me being on your TV screen for a total of 45 seconds in one episode of Guy Code, I'm in your ears 2 hours a week. You know my family. You know my brother. You know my friends. You know the shitty things that are happening to me. You know the good things that are happening to me. You know the girl that I'm dating. You know everything about my life. I'm one of your good friends. You know more about me than you know about most of the people that you work with. So if I come to your city, yeah, you're going to come say what's up. You already invested all this time in my life. You're going to not say hi when I'm here?
Yeah.
It's a different relationship with podcasts. When I speak to people who listen to podcasts, I'm not speaking to fans. I'm speaking to people who know me. It's a different relationship.
What are some common mistakes you're seeing comedians make? Because everybody wants to generate a fan base and everybody has their own idea of what works. But you seem to have a really interesting and smart view on kind of how this game works. So really any insight you have would be greatly appreciated.
I don't know, man. I've always searched for leverage. You know, I grew up in a small family business. My parents, they owned a business. They owned a dance studio. But I saw the leverage that they had. You know, they owned the studio. So my dad could take off work if he needed to take me to a basketball game or some shit, you know. My mom, you know, they always look for leverage in things. You know, my mom was immigrant. She was from Scotland, stopped going to school like 15, ends up buying property in New York, you know, because of her success and like buys a beach house. But even with the beach house and that kind of shit, her mentality was, well, we could just rent this out if we need to pay for something. We could just rent the home here in New York out if we need to do something. Like, how do you know, the second they bought the home in New York, they created an apartment within it to rent it out. It was constantly safety and security.
Mm.
So with me, I'm thinking that with my career all the time. Okay, if this shit with MTV stops, what do I got? Well, I got this podcast popular. Okay, that's going to sustain me financially. Okay, good. Now I got to branch shit off on the podcast. How do I create leverage in the world? Oh, can I get people to a show? Yeah. Can I get more people to a show than some of these people who are on TV? Yeah. Maybe the clubs won't recognize that at first, but once I come there, boom. So how do you have leverage in this business? These guys on social media, who frankly aren't even close to as funny as many of my favorite comedians, have all the leverage. They're making way more money than people on TV now because they have leverage. They could say, hey, I got 8 million fans and I can tell 8 million people to watch this show. How much is that worth to you, NBC? How much is that worth to you, Netflix? It's worth real money. If you're a really funny comedian, but you only got 1,000 followers on Instagram, you can only tell 1,000 people to come to your show. Now NBC's got to do all the work in getting people to come to the show. If I'm NBC and this Instagram comedian who auditions just as well as this 1,000 follower comedian did, it's a no brainer who I'm gonna pick.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how much better you are gonna have to be for that role if you have no leverage in order to be chosen. You got to be. It's worth not telling 8 million people for free. Funny.
So is that your whole game was you want to get undeniably funny first? So.
That's first. Not everything comes from that, and you're always growing.
And you were, I loved your hustle with that because you would actually transcribe like Dave Chappelle's specials. You were looking at the math,
yeah,
of comedy. Or do you still take that same approach in analyzing your sets now?
It's more like the Matrix now. It's more like Neo. You know, like Neo when he sees the green shit. Like that's how it is when you watch comedy now. You're just like, oh, I see what he did there. Okay. Uh-huh. Back in the day, you didn't know how to see the Matrix, right? So you had to write it down and really fucking translate. What is he doing here? How is his premise and how does, okay, blah, blah. Like I was trying to understand the language of comedy. Mm-hmm. So now I understand the language. So it's less, like, I don't even like watching famous guys because I don't want them to influence me. But if I do watch it, it will just be like, okay, this is really, it's more to inspire me to push it further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Dave Chappelle's recent special, I love the structure of it. So now I'm thinking about with specials, it's like, it's got to be more than just an hour of jokes. There's got to be some arc.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's got to be something pulling this whole thing together. What is it? So now that's how I'll think about a special because of him.
And you actually funded your own special, right?
Yeah, I shot my own. Yeah, and we've been struggling to sell it, man. It's a perfect example. Like, you would think that that would be a no-brainer, you know? I shot a sitcom, sitcoms on Netflix. People see, you know, you go see me live. That's undeniable in terms of, you know, funny. I've been on TV. I have a podcast, 250,000 subscribe, you know, people listen. Like, you would think that with these things, it's a no-brainer. Compared to the people that are getting opportunities for specials.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I could chalk it up to is, I mean, honestly, I don't even understand it. Besides the fact that like maybe 30-year-old white guys aren't cool right now to give a special to. That's the only thing I could chalk it up to.
You think it's the structure? Because isn't yours like in 15-minute chunks?
Which makes it even better. Places?
It's unique.
That's even better. Like, so the way I did the special was I did 5 different comedy clubs in New York, and I taped the hour over those 5 clubs. And then I taped the cab rides in between. So it gives you an idea of what the night was. Like, this is a night in New York. For people who are comedy fans, there's folklore to be a New York comedian. Mm-hmm. So you could do 20 spots a night. You could do whatever. So like, this is a real inside look at what it is to be a New York comic. And I gave you the hour special as well. And I did this purposely because I knew if I just did a regular special, it wouldn't be enough. I knew how big I had to be as a celebrity in order to sell a special. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I knew I didn't have that just on name. Right. Cause I don't have any other like box to check off. Like if I, you know what I'm saying? If I was like part penguin and I was doing a comedy, then it would be like, he's a penguin guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You got to check out this penguin person's comedy special or whatever. Right. So I knew that. So I'm like, what I'll do is I'll make something artistic as well. I'll increase the equity of this special, increase the value. Right. That's how I'm thinking about
mm-hmm.
it. And we've been talking to people, you know, we've been back and forth with certain people, and there's interest in certain places and just certain places where like, no, sorry, your name's not big enough. This, that, the other.
Oh,
yeah.
What?
Oh, I was depressed, man. I was like, what's wrong? Am I not getting this? Like, it's very difficult to go on a road, crush, go in a city, crush with the same material and be like, no, I know this is good material. I feel proud of it. And then be rejected over and over again for the special, right? Because you're like, was it not good material? What's going on? You got to like rewatch it and be like, no, it's good, right?
Yeah,
I believe in this kind of stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. It was a very difficult time for me, man.
So you were actually, like, you were depressed? Like, you actually...
I was just down on it. Yeah, I was down on comedy. I was down on, you know, I was just down on myself. I thought it would sell in a fucking day. Like, that we were getting no's from places I didn't even want to sell it to. Like, I was like, yeah, you can show it to Showtime, but I'm not going to give it to, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to sell it to them, you know what I mean? We're going Netflix or HBO, that's it, you know? Like, and then when they were saying no, I was like, what do you mean no? What is it? I didn't get the chance to say no first, you know? So it was just a reality check.
So what do you, what do you think's missing? Or like, what are you trying to do to make sure it happens? Like you said, you set goals and you make sure you be specific about what you want to happen. So you want this to be released. What do you,
well, I mean, I basically decide this, and my feeling with this, what I thought was a no brainer is I have this podcast that has 250,000 people listening per episode. This is my leverage. This is what I can offer a network. I can bring these people to you to watch this show. I know that you're not choosing people for your specials based on just comedic merit, right? Because I see the specials. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's not to shit on people, but you know, it is what it is. There's, you know, comedy's not entirely subjective. We know that there's funny specials. We know there's not funny specials. Yep. It's just how the reality is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I'm Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle is arguably the greatest comedian ever. I'm not saying I'm Patrice O'Neill is arguably the greatest comedian ever. But there are people who have specials out that I know that I'm funnier than, and this is a better special than. So I felt like my leverage would be, okay, you're giving this person a special, but he can't bring you numbers and eyes. I can offer something funnier and numbers and eyes. Like, this is a business transaction. Let's treat this like business. I have people who want to see the special, plus you have your people who like comedy. Let's bring these two worlds together. Ta-da. No brainer. Some people, it's a brainer, I guess.
Yeah. For everyone so far, I guess.
It was very difficult. Very difficult. So what I basically said was, look, if we don't get it sold soon, what I'm going to do is release it myself. And I'll prove the product myself.
Mm.
I think that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I tell everybody to do. Everybody complains about the industry as being so racist, this, that, the other. Just make your own movie. If it's successful, everybody will want to make a movie with you.
And that is the good thing about having the power and having numbers, is that you can do it your way now. And another guy, of course, your right-hand man, Charlemagne, has done it his way as well.
Absolutely. I mean,
this guy is another rising stock. What have you learned?
It's unbelievable.
From working side by side with this guy?
It's just unbelievable talent. He's probably the most talented person I've ever worked with.
Uh-huh.
He's unbelievable, relentless work ethic, and just an unbelievable talent. And he's made me much better at what I do. That's for sure. You know, just made me really buckle down and, like, you know, I'm confident. I speak well enough and bullshit well enough where I can get people to believe shit even if I don't have anything to back it up. And he does that even better than I do. So what he forced me to do was find statistics and research to back up my claims. Because if we just get into a bullshit convo, he's going to win. He's an unbelievable bullshitter. Unbelievable. Nobody's better, right, at just the art of, like, communicating a point. He just knows how to do it. And so what it forced me to do is get my point and then get things that are irrefutable to back it up. And it made me a much better communicator. I'm very grateful for him for forcing me to do that. It's not like something he told me to do, but it's something that working with somebody who's that good made me do.
It helped you with the business side as well?
Help me, absolutely. His business acumen's great. I mean, he's just, his strategy is good strategy. But it was just one of those things where it's like, and the podcast made me realize this, it's like, if you build it and it works, people will fuck with you. You know, and that's why I say to everybody, it's like, and I take my own advice, like with this special, I'll put it out myself, prove that people fuck with it, prove that it's hot, make it hot with my fans and supporters from the podcast and other things. And then all of a sudden, the industry would be like, oh, we noticed that your special is really good. We would love to work with you on another special. When a week ago, it was, nah, we're good.
Yeah.
That's how this business works. They want to be second. That's what everybody keeps complaining. They go, oh my God, it's so racist. No, they just don't want to be the first one. You know, Empire comes out, right? You always hear this shit about, it's like, oh, they're not giving black people opportunities in Hollywood. Empire comes out, right? Success. Immediately after Empire comes out, they release Power on Stars. VH1 has This Is the Beat or something like that, or the Beats or the whatever. Netflix releases another hip hop based show called,
oh yeah,
by Buzz Lerman. FX releases Atlanta. Literally every channel releases their version of a hip hop show, hip hop music kind of show. That is what Hollywood is. Once you prove that it works, everybody else wants a piece of it. So it's not that Hollywood is explicitly racist and meaning they're like we got to keep Asians out of Hollywood. We got to keep whatever out of Hollywood. We got to keep black people out of Hollywood. That's not about what it's about. It's one, they're clueless. They're just so detached from anything that isn't their exact world. And two, they're just not willing to risk the money. Once you prove it makes money, do whatever the fuck you want. The guy who made Get Out, Jordan Peele or whatever, he can make whatever he wants now. He can make whatever he wants. It's a blank check for whatever his next movie is because he proved the product. So if no one's giving me an opportunity, I'm going to take my own advice. I'm going to sell the fucking product. I'm going to get all my friends to, you know, support it, hopefully, and tell people about it. You know, go on podcasts like this, promote it, do grassroots, get people to talk about it, and hopefully get some buzz. And the people themselves show that, hey, there's interest in what I do. And then we have all these conversations with the you know, the networks. And then I get to remind them that they said no the first time.
And then that gives you the leverage, though.
I don't need you.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? My dick's getting sucked. Why should I pull my dick out of this girl's mouth so you could suck it? That's the that's where we're going. So now you got to prove my dick's getting sucked and it's lovely. Right? So now you're coming over and you're like, I want to suck your dick. And it's like, all right, well, what are you going to do different? You know what I mean? Because I'm gonna come with this. So what are you gonna do? You know what I mean? I wanted you to suck my dick. That's why I came to you. You know what I mean? I came to you first so you could suck my dick, and you said no. So now you're gonna need some extra shit.
Dude, what a great analogy. That was
that's what this business is, man. You can't be upset. Don't be bitter. Just be better.
Boom.
And we better be better, man. That's really what it comes down to.
Don't be bitter, be better.
That's what it is. That's why everybody gets all upset about, like, there's a lack of opportunity. Like, I even hear people saying this shit, like, oh, they aren't giving, you know, white guys roles anymore, this, that, the other. Like, I hear people, industry people saying this shit. And it's like, good, let it. Too. Good. This is, what are you upset about? First of all, it's good that we have diversity in Hollywood. Second, it's just going to make you better. It's going to make you write your own project. It's going to make you write the role that you actually want instead of just lazily going to any fucking audition.
Are you writing any more pilots or anything right now?
I'm kind of like off and on working on this show. But
you sound super enthused about it.
No, I'm really enthused to work with because I was working on it with Whitney Cummings, and I think she's just so fucking brilliant, so talented, and I really like working with her on it. But I'm not passionate enough about it to work on it on my own as of now. I'm passionate to work with her on it, and I think we could create something really funny and really special.
Seems like you're good at surrounding yourself with the right people.
I'm picky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I have a very small circle. You know, I'm not really like one of these, and that's probably why I don't get certain opportunities the other comics get. Like, I don't get invites to these festivals and that kind of shit like that, because I don't really hang out with comics that much. I have my close comic friends, and it's just, I like the people I like. So if I like you, I'll fuck with you and I want to be around you. But it's very difficult for me to be around you if I don't think you're funny. You know what I'm saying? Because like, I'm going to want to help you, but if I don't think you're funny, it's hard for me to help you.
Yeah.
But if I think you're funny, I'm going to force you into shit. Like, I forced my buddy Akash into getting jobs when they said no to him. Like, I just told him to keep coming. And eventually they just buckled down and just started paying them. You know, like, but like, if I believe in you, that will happen. So I believe, you know, before Charlamagne was Charlamagne, he was just this other guy on the show with me on Guy Code. And then he had a morning show, The Breakfast Club, that I never listened to because I listened to Hot 97 my whole life growing up. If you're in New York, 105.1 was like this other shit. Hot 97 is what we listened to. Now Hot 97 is trash. Now it's all The Breakfast Club. But, you know, for real New Yorkers, we never listened to 105.1. So it was just somebody who I saw on the show and I gravitated to because I thought he was truly talented, you know? And that's why I wanted to work with him. I feel the same way with Lil Duval. There are plenty of people that were on that show that I just don't work with regularly. And they're really nice guys. And I think that they have great talent in certain areas, but it just wasn't, I didn't want to like create with them. I didn't have that urge.
What is your writing regimen? Are you daily? Do you have a daily discipline? Like, because you're doing a lot.
I need to get more discipline.
Yeah.
I'm more disciplined with preparing for the podcast.
Okay.
But in terms of writing, I need to get more discipline. I need to put that in the schedule and just take some time and just like talk out ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I need to do that.
You're more, you more vocal. I like interviewed Mark Norman on here,
yeah,
and he said his whole writing process is he just walks around the room for an hour talking through bits. Are you more vocal or you pen to paper more?
I can do that more. I'm definitely not pen to paper. I've never been pen to paper. Mm-hmm. I like conversation. That's how I write. Like if I have a talk with somebody,
mm-hmm,
and we're talking about an idea, that's where it will come out. Like I'll be like, oh, okay, this is what's going on or something. That's funny. There's something there. That's good. Da da da.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that will be it. That's the, I don't, it's very hard for me to just be like, oh, here's a joke.
One of my favorite jokes of yours is the Mexicans stealing our jobs.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That
yeah,
joke
yeah.
is absolutely brilliant and thank so you. Well put together.
Thank you, like, man. I should put that shit up before there's no more Mexicans here.
Dude, it's
shit too. You ever hear people say that about that the Mexicans are stealing the jobs? You ever hear people say that? You never heard that? You never heard that? Lying ass motherfucker right now. I'm not making that up though, right? I'm not. First of all, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard in my life. How the fuck do you steal a job? I never seen a Mexican walk into a restaurant, give me the dishes. That shit never happened in my fuck. No, no, we don't want the money. Rub your gloves on the ground. Don't touch my palm olives. So stupid. If you're going to steal a job, wouldn't you steal a great job? Like, who is deciding to steal these fucking jobs? That's what I want to know. Are you ready to steal some jobs today? Yeah, minimum wage, we can do worse. I wish they would steal a good. I wish 40 Mexicans would just raid the Apple store. The Genius Bar is ours! The fuck out of here, nerds! Mexicans that run the Apple store now. Just got nerds walking. What do you Mexicans know about selling Macs? If we can sell oranges, we can sell apples. Okay, get the fuck out of here. This shit is easy.
In talking about that joke for just a second,
sure.
Did it start with you hearing maybe in conversation people saying Mexicans are stealing our jobs and then you just take it to this whole other level? How did you kind of develop that joke?
I've always had like an affinity for Mexicans and Mexican culture. You know, I lived in Spain and I came back to California and I worked in restaurants with these guys who literally would work 18 hours a day. 7 days a week, 6-7 days a week. I have families here, send money back to their families there, and they tell me these amazing stories of how they got into America and like just hearing about what they're able to do just to support their families back home. I just had this real, I don't know, I just thought they were just such a special people, man. Like mm-hmm. really special people. And,
yeah.
And I would hear people saying, ah, they're stealing the jobs, that kind of stuff like that. It just didn't sit right to me. So it was my way of kind of like defending these people who I didn't think were stealing jobs. I thought they were doing the American thing that we've done for years here, which is a new immigrant class comes and they do the jobs nobody else wants to do. And that's how it started.
But then to actually make it funny, like we're like, oh, give me your dishes
that. Yeah, it's just, I don't know why I thought that. I don't even know. I forget how this came about, man. I wonder if it started,
You have a lot of good examples in there. I guess you had to go through a lot of failed examples.
That joke
examples.
Has evolved. It's been a long time. Like there's been a long. I mean, that joke's been around a while. That was like one of my first jokes that did really well.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones that did very. You know, you have these jokes. I'm sure you recognize it as a stand-up where you're just like, "All right, this one works." Like I can remember the first mm-hmm. joke that worked consistently and then the first joke that really kind of killed
And yeah.
Yeah, just clicks. Some just come together.
Yeah, they just come together. Yeah. You know, you get these fun. So that was one of them. I'm trying to think exactly what the. Oh, man, I don't know exactly where it came about. Oh, that's a bummer that I can't remember that. But yeah, it's evolved, and then there's this whole other thing. I don't know if I did the whole thing. Did I do the Apple
you
store?
You did with
thing?
The Apple, and if we can sell oranges, we can sell Apple.
Yeah. Sell apples.
Just making that connection. I mean, do you just write on stage more? Like, you just talk about stealing our jobs, and that just kind of came together piece by piece over time?
Basically, yeah. Okay. I just thought it was kind of silly. Like, that's how things happen to me. Like, the idea of, like I'll think about something. I'll be honest. The one thing that annoys me about that joke is it's likable. Like, the joke is pretty likable. Like, I think most people have, you know, a little bit of compassion for Mexican immigrants, right? I tend to gravitate towards humor that you have no compassion for.
Definitely. And then you defend it.
And then I defend it, right? So this is a joke that, like, I'm kind of like a good guy on, which is the one thing I don't like about that. Being said, it's like something I do believe in. You know what I mean? I like being a bad guy in every joke. That's definitely fun. But yeah, that's what it comes to, is like, you hear somebody say something, they're stealing the jobs, or even like with the grab the pussy thing. And like, I'll just ruminate on that. I'm like, grabbing the pussy, is it wrong to grab the pussy? Like, how do you grab a pussy? Like, have I ever grabbed a pussy? Yeah, I've grabbed. Matter of fact, I've always grabbed pussy. I never asked for permission to grab pussy. I just grab pussy, right? So like, that's where it goes, right?
Yeah.
You know, instead of just like accepting conventional wisdom, which is all these people think it's wrong. Okay, I'll think it's wrong.
Yeah, it's impressive that you did that joke, and you're like, but you've never met a billionaire. You exactly. had women clapping.
Yeah.
At that. That's just amazing to just flip people like that. It was really fun to watch.
I'm glad you liked it, man.
Yeah, man. It was great to see you work live, and it was great for you to share this time with me, man.
My brother.
I really appreciate your generosity.
For sure.
Before we get out of here, is there anything else you want the world to know?
Oh, man, they could check out all the things I'm doing just on my podcast, The Brilliant Idiots, and also just Twitter and Instagram. I usually, you know, keep posted. That's Andrew Schultz, Schulz.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but yeah, man, thanks for having me, bro. Appreciate it.
And check him out on Sneaky Pete too. He makes a little cameo,
Pete,
on
man.
That.
Yeah, that was a cool couple episodes, man.
But yeah, Andrew Schultz, thanks for being on Hot Breath, man.
My brother, thank you very much.
All right.
Comedy game for days on this one, all right? I told you, if you found it educational, if you found it valuable, hit up Andrew Schultz on all his social media. Flood him. Listen, there is nothing that's going to spread the Hot Breathiverse faster and more effectively than if you reach out to these guests we have and let them know, yo, this episode you did on Hot Breath, that's the real deal. That's my favorite interview you've ever done. Please, you got to get back on there ASAP. And they'll do it. They reach out to me and let me know. These guests are like, yo, the Hot Breathiverse really rallies around. Like, I've got contacted by multiple listeners saying how much they enjoyed the interview. So if you enjoyed this interview, go hit them up. Let them know. Let them know this is the one. It's so many gems, man. I am so excited about where this podcast is headed. We just launched our website, hotbreathpodcast.com. We are on the universe now when it comes to the internet. We have our own website. Go on there. We've got a blog going. We've got all the episodes you need and a link to our merch. If you want to check out all the Hot Breath merch we have, you want to support the Hot Breathiverse, wear your jersey. You know, we're not selling jerseys. We're selling t-shirts and socks and stickers and hoodies and sweatshirts and such. But, you know, rep the brand. And we're going to keep building here with the help of you. This is a comedy community we are building together. So if you want to connect with other listeners, a great way to do that, Facebook. We created our own Facebook page called Hot Breath Comedy Network. Just go on Facebook, search that, request to join, connect with other listeners from around the world, and let's keep building, baby. Thank you to everyone that came out to my game show. I host a monthly game show here in Atlanta at the Laughing Skull. Absolutely amazing. Salute to everyone that just joined my new comedy writing class. Everyone in there is like a hot brethren and sistren. Almost everyone in there is like, yo, Hot Breath. And what's dope about you all listening, I'm not even kidding, in my comedy classes, I used to use Hot Breath as like a case study, playing quotes from comedians to kind of reinforce what I was talking about. Today in class, my students were quoting Hot Breath. I was talking about something, we were talking about a writing exercise, and I was talking about how important it is and how it's not about trying to be funny, but it's more just looking for the interesting and looking for the fascinating moments within your writing. And then they quoted me talking about that in a recent podcast, and like all of them knew about it. And it's just so motivational, seriously, because this podcasting is a grind. This comedy is a grind. But if we can all be on this grind together, it's going to help everyone win. So that being said, thank you all. Congratulations to all. Seriously, you investing the time into this podcast means you're investing time into your comedy. And if you know another comedian that could benefit from this, you're at an open mic, be like, yo, you saw Andrew Schultz on Joe Rogan? You got to hear him on Hot Breath. Will come a hot breathing. So all that being said, thank you for all your support. JoelByersComedy.com is the website. HotBreathPodcast.com is the podcast website. We're just going to grow and keep building and interacting. I love hearing from you and what you like about these episodes. And that's all it is, man. Keep grinding out there, kids. Comedy ain't easy, but it's worth it. And together we can keep it comedy. A lot of people are doing comedy right now, but it's my mission to help comics suck less. That's a working tagline. We'll figure it out. But in the meantime, in between time, if you're looking to write some new jokes or turn your dirty jokes into clean jokes or get some feedback on your 5-minute sets, I offer all sorts of Skype sessions, and I'll do set analysis or even like, you know, one-on-one sessions in public, in public, as opposed to on Reddit. I don't know. Long story short, I'm here to help people on the podcast and off. If you want to connect, schedule a writing session or whatnot, I'm the man here to help you as much as I can. So stay on that grind, and we'll see you on the next one. All right? I'm going to get back to this show. I hope you're finding this episode and getting motivated to go out and do your own show. And I'll see you right here. Thank you to my wife. I almost forgot to thank my wife because sitting here in my car recording this on my phone. Thank you to my wife for recording the theme song for this podcast. And of course, thank you to you, Hot Brethren and Sister. And we'll see you right here next Monday on Hot Breath. Hot Breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.